let me introduce our first speaker to you. We're very happy to be able to bring such a distinguished panel to you today. Our first speaker is Dr. Robin Stone. She's the Executive Director and CEO of the International Longevity Center, USA. Prior to this position, she was the Acting Assistant Secretary for Aging at the United States Department of Health and Human Services. In this position, she provided leadership for the Administration on Aging, which included the staff in 120 central offices, 55 regional offices. Prior to this, she was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Disability, Aging, and Long-Term Care Policy. She was also a research analyst for the Bipartisan Commission on Comprehensive Health Care, more commonly known as the PEPPER Commission. Her own research has functioned on functional disability among the elderly and the non-elderly, home health care, home and community-based alternatives, caregiving, and managed care. She has over 50 publications in journal articles, book chapters, monographs, testimonies. She has served or is presently serving on the editorial boards of several scientific journals, including The Gerontologist, Health Affairs, and Research on Aging. She has presentations too numerous to mention. She did 14 just in 1998 alone, including the keynote address at the World Health Organization International Symposium in Japan and another international conference in the Netherlands. She's received several awards, too, which I'm going to mention. The 1998 Key Pharmaceutical Award for Leadership in Health and Aging, and also the Claude Pepper Award for Excellence in Community-Based Long-Term Care from the National Council on Aging and the Pepper Foundation. So we're extremely pleased to have someone of Robin's stature be with us today. And as she's coming to the mic, I want you to take a long, hard look at her and see if she looks familiar to you. Even if you haven't met her before, you may have seen her just a couple weeks ago on the evening news talking about, what else, long-term care. So join me in welcoming Dr. Stone. The title of her talk is Long-Term Care, Coming of Age in the 21st Century.
These introductions always bring ruddiness to my complexion. It's very not at the most comfortable status. And I must say that Josh and Alan and I have worked a lot together. We all were involved in some way, shape, or form in the work on health care reform in the early 90s in the first Clinton administration. And so we all have the bruises and some of the emotional stress that that we experienced through that time. But the positive part of that activity, I think, in many ways, was the real coming together at the federal level of folks who were looking at long-term care issues across the age span. And frankly, if I were to say one of the unintended consequences, I think, of that activity, it was that we had a much more gelling of the groups, even though you still hear that there are problems in Wisconsin, and it's not surprising. Alan looked at me when you were talking about how this long-term care proposal got bogged down. Special interests are clearly with us forever, I think, in the long-term care arena as they are in other areas. But I do believe that, at least in many circles, we have begun to come together to talk about these issues and to look at what is generic and what needs to be specific for different populations. I'd also like to commend the Family Impact Seminar for doing this, this session on long-term care. I was commenting to Karen that I have found over and over again the problem with recognizing the elderly in particular as part of a family. And it's been absolutely surprising to me over the years, because I've been working in aging for 25 years, that somehow when we think of families, we think of maternal and child health, mothers, children, working age people, and elderly sort of fall off the radar screen. Well, in fact, with the demographic changes, as Karen and I were talking about, we're probably going to be experiencing more of a family life in an elderly family than we ever have before. So these become very compelling issues, I think, for the attention of looking at family impact, because frankly, that's what long-term care issues are all about. And I also wanted to just put in a plug for this Aging Society Profile of Four States, if you haven't picked it up. We actually did a seminar for media in Milwaukee. It was our first site of a series that we're doing across the country. And as part of that series for the media, we produced, together with the National Academy on an Aging Society, this short piece on an aging profile, but it gives you a sense of where Wisconsin fits with some of your neighboring states. I think it might be enlightening for you legislators who would like to know what's happening on your borders and, you know, where Wisconsin is falling in some of these areas. I also wanted to just highlight long-term care with a couple of cartoons. I sort of track the status of long-term care and health care in cartoons. They do a better job than, I think, anybody. And this one is, this is Dr. Krivorkian. You have a condition that will cause prolonged suffering? Yes, my kids are putting me in a nursing home. And for better or for worse, I think this is the prevailing notion of institutional care in the United States. I think it's probably something that is warranted. It's also something that we have to deal with seriously. I don't think that we're going to see nursing homes going away anytime in the near future. And just as we focus on home and community-based alternatives, I think we also have to think about how we continue to improve the nursing home environment for folks who really may need to be there. The second cartoon, which I think is so lovely, and this really shows the family dynamic here, when you're old and living with me, you're going to bed at 7:30. And I think this really shows you the lifespan approach to family caregiving. Long-term care, what is it? It's really a broad range of services needed by individuals with some type of either chronic illness or disabling condition over a long, prolonged period of time. It's highly correlated, but not synonymous at all with medical conditions. And I think that's a really important point for us to remember, that some people tend to equate long-term care with health care, and in fact, they are related but not synonymous. It's primarily low-tech, supportive services to minimize, rehabilitate, or compensate for loss of independent functioning. And the functioning is really the key here. In long-term care, we really do take a functional approach. And finally, it can also include high-tech medical care, and more we're seeing that. And I think that that is where there's some real blurring of the lines, for some populations at least, in terms of where the acute and post-acute and long-term care worlds begin and end. I'm not sure we have any answers to that, but I think it's something that you as legislators need to be aware of. I also, rather than you all taking copious notes, I can make copies of these overheads, and we can get them out to all of you, so you don't really have to spend your time doing that. What are the settings? They're clearly a range from nursing home, residential care, including assisted living facilities, board and care, adult foster homes. These are not that easily differentiated, frankly. The assisted living world is primarily a state world, and that means that we have at least 51 varieties of these types of options. Home care, which can be delivered in one's own home or in the family home, and we do know that as people age and have more disabilities, they do tend to live with another family member. And adult daycare and other options in the community are also settings where these kinds of services can be provided. What are the services? Assistance with activities of daily living. Do most of you know what an ADL is? If you don't, then you need to go back to Long-Term Care 101. That is the acronym that has sort of been driving a lot of discussion around eligibility, severity of disability, at least in the aging world. And I think Alan may point to some of the issues where there are some concerns about trying to develop one generic measurement for long-term care needs because they vary depending on the population. But activities of daily living tend to focus on the personal care needs and personal hygiene needs of individuals. The assistance with instrumental activities of daily living, which include household chores, life management, medication management, is a very important IADL, which we're finding is more and more predictive of a lot of negative outcomes, or positive, depending on how it's managed. And transportation is another important IADL. But then we're also looking at more and more a range of other kinds of modalities, intravenous drug therapy, ventilator assistance, wound care, and then all of the rehab therapies. So you can see that there's a tremendous range of services that may or may not be included under the rubric of long-term care, in large part depending upon what's financed, what's reimbursed, and what isn't. Care costs can definitely be devastating for long-term care. Public funds, for the most part, are only caring for the poor or those who spend down to Medicaid levels. The near poor lack sufficient resources, and this is a population, the near poor and modest, moderate income folks who really are bearing the brunt of a lot of the costs today. Public funding continues to be slanted toward institutions. There's a lack of a sufficient trained workforce, and I would say as legislators, this is a sleeper and one that really needs to be paid attention to, and that is, do we have a trained professional and paraprofessional workforce to deal with these issues today and in the future? That goes from physicians to nurses to therapists to the paraprofessional worker who is the frontline worker. Families who provide long-term care need assistance, and we saw with the President's new proposal for long-term care that at least there is lip service being paid to family caregivers with a $1,000 tax credit, which I have some could make some comments about, but I do think that it has at least raised the spectrum of the need to really support families and limited availability and access to home and community-based care services. Coming full circle, this is sort of what has happened over time. I think it's important for all of us to sort of begin to understand this. We historically had a focus on acute care, and then over the years we had this emergence of chronic care and long-term care, but they're really not the same, and more you may hear people talking about chronic care, and I think that it becomes extremely confusing where these lines really begin and end, but they aren't the same. There was a tremendous attempt to bifurcate medical and social models of care, particularly in the 1970s, a strong movement by the social work community, for example, and an acknowledgement that long-term care was primarily low-tech and social and related to the social needs of the person. Then we move into the late 80s and the early 90s with new definitions of post-acute and subacute care, where we begin to move people out of hospitals. We even bypass the operating room or the ICU and take people out of these places and put them into skilled nursing facilities with significant movement in the post-acute world. The blurring of the lines between acute and chronic long-term care, and now a lot of rhetoric around integrated care. And I guess I don't know how many of you hear those buzzwords here in Wisconsin, but that's on the lips of every policymaker. Somehow there's this magic bullet in which we're going to integrate acute and long-term care. We're going to figure out how we streamline financing. We're going to bring it all together, and this is going to work in a holistic way for people with chronic disabilities who have long-term needs but also have acute flare-ups and exacerbations. It's a wonderful, wonderful concept. I will tell you that going around the country, we haven't seen very much of it in practice. Just to give you some quick statistics, this is something that is not new to any of you. This is the aging of America. As you can see, we're going to experience tremendous increase in the numbers and proportion of both the over 65 and probably more importantly for the 85 and over for the long-term care population is the increase in the 85 and over population, because that's where we really begin to see long-term care needs. The prevalence of functional limitations among elderly and non-elderly populations in 1995, you can see that for the under age 65, we're talking about 2%, 0.1% nursing home residents, 2% community residents with functional limitations, and the rest living in the community. Obviously, if you compare that with the 65 and over population, the prevalence of functional limitation is higher both in the community and in nursing homes. That's not surprising given the relationship between disability and age. On the other hand, the under 65 population, and I'm sure Alan will highlight this as well, is a significant, important, and probably growing population because of all the advances we have made in both our medical technology, but also sort of the social environment. Prevalence of long-term care need among the elderly by age. This is just to show you how quickly it goes up by age. With the 65 to 74-year-olds, we're talking about a relatively modest proportion with long-term care needs. And this long-term care needs, by the way, includes people just with needs for instrumental activities of daily living. So it can be fairly low disability levels. But if you see the 85 and over population, you're really talking about a significant chunk of that population with some type of long-term care needs. Percentage of elderly community residents with functional limitations by age. This shows you the also by severity of disability. And here again, I think the point to be made is what really happens as you get older. And that we're really talking about the old in the population with significant long-term care needs, and where we really need to be paying attention because of the growth in this population in the 21st century. Percentage of community residents age 65 by expected lifetime nursing home use. We are expecting almost 40%, that's 2 out of 5, will have some lifetime nursing use after age 65. And as you can see, we're looking at about 20% with more than 1 year, and 8% with more than 5 years. You can say the glass is half empty or the glass is half full, depending upon how you look at that risk for lifetime nursing home use. I just wanted to highlight for you the some of the data that are coming out of some of our national databases. And we've actually seen now some affirmation of these trends in other country databases as well. And that is, we are looking at a decline in the rate of disability among the elderly. And you can see what would happen to the disability rates if you change the assumptions around the rate over time. And I think the important point to be made here is that I wouldn't extrapolate too much from that into tremendous savings or the less need for long-term care in the future. And that argument has been made by a number of people, that if we are seeing a decline in disability rates, that suggests that there may be savings for the Medicare program. We may not need to invest as much publicly at the state level. I think the jury is out on that. And in fact, there are some who argue that with declines in disability rates and people living longer, that there may be, that the very nature of these disability rates declining, the investment in more medical technology, which is actually more expensive, is what is related to this. And so the cost may actually be higher and not lower. I'm not sure that we don't have an answer to that. All I'm saying to you is be cautious, be aware when you hear these statistics that this does not mean that we're not going to be dealing with a cost issue and a demand issue in the future. I also wanted to just show you, this is just to show you, this is elderly beneficiaries. These are Medicare beneficiaries, which is the main population for the elderly needing long-term care, are disproportionately female. And I think that's an important point for us, that we know aging is a female issue, but long-term care is also a female issue. And we need to really be aware of that when we deal with this at the policy level. The other point to be made here is that Medicare beneficiaries who need a lot of long-term care also need a lot of acute care. And this, I think, emphasizes, again, the relationship between the acute and long-term care needs, that particularly as people age with chronic disabilities, there are also a lot of acute care needs. And we really can't deal with either of these in a vacuum. The question of what kind of policies we might want to strive towards in terms of bringing these worlds together, I think, is the subject of a lot of debate, some experimentation, but to my mind, not as much as I would like to see around the country. Now to just move to the informal care sector for a while. These are some estimates from the National Survey of Families and Households. And this just gives you a sense of, for adults 20 to 75, who are providing informal care, and that is the unpaid care to a family member with some type of a long-term care need. 7% are providing care to friends. 24% are providing care to family members. So we've got 31% of adults between 20 to 75 providing informal care. That's almost a third. That gives you a sense of the magnitude of this investment, this unpaid investment in all of our communities. And needless to say, over and over again, I will point out the fact that long-term care, for the most part, is a family issue. Families do most of it. They do most of it across the life course. And one of the goals of policy really needs to be, how do we support families in these endeavors? Because frankly, we're never going to have a system in this country that is going to replace informal care with some type of formal system. So we really do need to be focusing on that as a major goal. The recipients of informal care, 38% were parents, 11% were spouses, 7% were children, and 24% were non-kin. I think this is also an important point around the sort of non-fictive kin and that whole world that's developing and what that's going to mean for the 21st century. What that means also in terms of policy, when you think about, for example, providing assistance to family, do we think about non-fictive kin? Do we think about friends that may be doing this? And I think as we see family structures change in the future, this is an issue that's going to be critical for us. The use of informal and formal care by community-dwelling elders with chronic disabilities, this is a very important point. And again, it highlights the informal care. 65% are receiving informal care only. 5.4% are receiving formal care only. So we are really talking about the vast majority of long-term care being provided informally by family and friends. Now let me run through a couple of other overheads quickly, because I'm trying to give you an overview, and Josh and Alan will be more specific. But let me just show you what we're spending right now for nursing home and home care by sources of funds in 1995. We were estimating about $106.5 billion with 21% federal Medicaid, 17.8% Medicare, 16.7% state Medicaid. So for you all at the state level, that's the chunk that's coming out. And 32.5% out of pocket. A third of these expenditures are coming out of pocket. Sources of nursing home payments, 1995, 46.5% Medicaid. That's the big chunk here. And 36.7% out of pocket. So we've got sort of this almost split between the program that was originally designed for the poor and money coming out of people's pockets. Just to show you the growth in Medicaid expenditures for long-term care services between 1987 and 1997, I think one of the important things here is to look at, for total Medicaid, we're talking about a 13.1%. The home and community-based waivers is 33.5%. Now, that doesn't mean that the waivers have taken over spending on institutional care. But what it does show is that we are moving in the direction of trying to create home and community-based alternatives. It's always nice to come to Wisconsin because this is a state that has done a lot of experimentation with home and community-based care. In fact, you all exported your COP program to Australia, if you don't know that. This is a state where we can actually say in some ways you've been on the forefront, although you've still got very high, if you look at your nursing home rates compared to some of the other states, you've got both high nursing home and high home and community-based care. So you're a sort of an interesting place to be. Very quickly, I also wanted to illustrate the Medicare trends. because Medicare has become more and more a home and community-based program. There is a debate on how to limit the growth in home health use. There are more people with chronic care needs. There are more long stayers who really look like a long-term care population. There's the emergence of subacute care, which, again, we don't know. The lines between subacute and long-term care are extremely fuzzy. And with the evolution of managed care and risk contracting, the question is whether we will ever see long-term care become part of that package. I just wanted to highlight the home health trends here. You can see that the increase in home health is really in the average number of visits per person. It's gone from 24 to 66 in 1994. And the visits for AIDS services increased from 34% of the total visits to 48%. This is basically a long-term care service that is being provided. And we know for a fact that many states have been maximizing Medicare to try to deal with their Medicaid budgets, either directly or indirectly. Now, of course, with a full-scale attack on Medicare home health and a cutting back of that through a number of different mechanisms in the Balanced Budget Act, I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens in the future because these programs have definitely become overlapping. And I think it's a real problem. It really highlights the problem of our fragmented financing system here, where we've got a lot of redundancy and duplication, and frankly, not the most efficient way of paying for or providing services. Let me just very quickly, I've got about a minute left, run through the emerging trends. Managed care, which is primarily acute and preventive, even though there's a lot of sort of discussion around managed care possibly being able to provide better holistic managed services for people with chronic disabilities. The fact of the matter is that we know that has not occurred for the most part. And in fact, with a lot of plans pulling out of markets now, there's some real issues around what's really going to be available in the future for the Medicare population, and particularly those who have chronic disabilities. Subacute care, integrated care, how much of it is a reality, and then consumer choice and autonomy in long-term care. And this is an area where we are seeing a lot of movement, cash and vouchers in home care, independent home care provider models where people hire and fire their own workers, and finally the world of assisted living, which at least in its philosophy suggests that we can develop residential care alternatives where we provide more choice and autonomy for folks, including pretty significantly disabled folks, in an environment where they trade off some of the safety and protection for that choice and the ability to manage their own risk. I think, frankly, if I were a state legislator, this is an area that I would be looking at significantly in the future. I think we're going to see a lot more experimentation with assisted living. It has been primarily a high-end market phenomenon, and the real question is, can we, through state policy, begin to think about how we make these options available to the modest income population as well? Thank you.
We're going to take a few minutes for questions. Just we have a few minutes if you have any questions for Dr. Stone.
You mentioned that Wisconsin costs for nursing home as well as in-home care is high. Could it be said that we take care of our senior citizens? I know what I've heard from a number of constituents is their parents will move south in their 60s, and then when they become, say, in their 70s or 80s, they move back to Wisconsin. Is that something that your study has shown?
I think Josh can probably, I don't know whether you can speak to that as well. I would say, without knowing the specifics of Wisconsin, a number of geographers who have actually looked at these out-migration and in-migration patterns, and I would suspect that that's probably the case, that you've got a lot of the old who are more chronically disabled moving back because of the rich environment here. I think the question that I raise around nursing home versus home and community-based care, and I'm not sure it's a... I think we've had a lot of debate over the years around the legitimacy of this question. But the question is, do you want to be substituting, really aggressively trying to substitute home and community-based services for institutional care? For example, as we have seen in state like Oregon, and that I think is a question that all states are grappling with. So yes, I would say it is definitely the case that Wisconsin is a good place to be for the elderly, but I think the other question facing you as state legislators is, how do you want to be making those options available in the future, and where do you want to be putting the focus in terms of having some influence on the delivery system and the kinds of providers that are going to be available to provide those services?
Okay. So there was one more question right here, I saw.
You mentioned that integrated care is a buzzword right now, but that you're not seeing it really happening anyplace across the country. Can you share some of your thoughts about why that is?
I wouldn't say I'm not seeing it. I mean, I think there are some interesting models, and clearly we know we've got on the very far end the PACE, the OnLock model in San Francisco, and the PACE replications, which for a very, very disabled nursing home certifiable population, where some have said it's a hospice benefit for, because virtually all of these folks die in that program. That is an example of a truly integrated system where they have been able to meld the acute and long-term care, but it's a very intensive system, very labor-intensive. And I think the question is, how do you develop these kinds of options for a more mainstream population where you triage people in? Not everybody is at that level of disability. There are people across the country that have a range of needs and are going to have a range of needs over time. And that, I think, is where we've had a lot more rhetoric than reality. Some of it has to do with the problems of financing and our separate funding streams that make it difficult to do. But I'm not sure it's all that. I also think it has to do with a lack of training and understanding really how you integrate services. I have visited a lot of integrated providers, and basically what they've done is to administratively integrate. But that is not integrating services. It's a very, very different thing. And I'm not sure what the problem is. My own view is we need to be focusing a heck of a lot more on training because we don't have providers across the spectrum that really understand the full range of needs of populations. And so consequently, even if you try to put the administrative structure in place, you are not necessarily going to get the integration at the person level, which is really what you want. I mean, we are thinking about beneficiaries here. So
we're going to take just one more quick question here, and we'll have to move on.
You had said that you might mention a little bit about the proposal to provide caregivers with a $1,000 tax break.
Yes. Well, briefly. I mean, I think it was, first of all, I take some, I was taken aback by the notion that this was the first long-term care activity in the distant past, because we spent, many of us in 1992, quite a bit of time developing a long-term care proposal in the Health Security Act that was a substantial move in the direction of home and community-based services for the population, also with $56 billion new dollars over 5 years. So I think the $1,000 tax credit is primarily a political move. If you look at who would benefit from that tax credit, if you look at what that really means in terms of $1,000, up to $1,000 for either a family or a disabled person who needs long-term care, I also always generally have problem with tax credits, because what you really need is the discretionary dollars while you're in service. And the fact of the matter is, on the other hand, I've also felt that you could see tremendous induced demand on this, because it's such an open-ended tax credit. You basically need a physician's signature. And my sense is, unless you've got the IRS going out there auditing everybody, almost anyone in that income category could be filing for a $1,000 tax credit. So I don't think it was an example of tremendously well thought out policy.